So this series, Renovate, is about how people change. And if you come into a church and you hear you need to change, one of our first thoughts is these religious people must have a list of dogma that we want you to become like and adhere yourself to. And I want to assure you, God is not interested in morality. God doesn't even have a list of morals for you to obey. Now, you might push back and say, what about the Ten Commandments? And we'll get there. But in the New Testament, Paul says the most dangerous lifestyle possible is to live a religious life. A religious life. Now, that surprises me. I would have thought maybe it's the lifestyle of the drug scene with the violence that's associated with that. Maybe it's a controlling, addictive life. Potentially, it could be communism or fascism or capitalism, some would say. Personally, I think maybe it would be veganism. I think that would kill me almost immediately. But Paul says above everything else, the most dangerous life is to be religious. And if anybody knew, Paul was the one to know. He said about his birthright, he's the greatest of Hebrews. Now, that's a big statement. It's like you saying, I'm the greatest American. In terms of zeal, I'm prosecuting and killing heretics. In terms of the law, I'm on the Supreme Court. In terms of morals, I am blameless. Now, these are religious statements, and Paul likes to make them until he's riding his horse on the way to Damascus, and he has an encounter with the resurrected Jesus Christ. Jesus, with mercy and grace, pushes him off of his horse, startles him awake. Paul sees Jesus, knows that the forgiveness of Jesus is true for his life, and Paul is radically changed instantly because of the greatness of Jesus. And then Paul looks back on his religious life and says about his religious life, it was a giant pile of crap. Now, I know I'm not supposed to say that word up front, but the Bible actually says a different word. It's a Greek curse word, and ironically, my morals won't let me say it up front. And so I said the C-rap word instead, and if you're bothered by that, it's kind of Paul's point that maybe your heart is taken with religiosity and you're more concerned with a word that comes out of your mouth instead of the darkness that's down in your heart. Right? And so the problem with religion and what makes it so dangerous is it's summarized in you accomplished. You did everything. You earned it. God couldn't, and so you did it. And that, to Paul, is worse than everything else. It's the ultimate danger. Now, that's interesting. If you were to think about ultimate dangers, I don't think that you would have put you accomplishing things at the top of the list. What is the ultimate danger in life? Is it death? Some would say that that's the case, and so they begin to pursue a safety and security. And some of us as Christians pray prayers that keep us hemmed in with your hedge of protection. And we ask for all of these type cautionary things. And if that's the case, that death is the ultimate danger and we should pursue safety, then maybe God's a monster. Because I don't see where God says, protect your life in the scriptures. I see instead, pour yourself out and that Jesus is worthy of every second and sweat for him and bleed for him and act like an Olympian athlete. Not running the 100 meters, but for 15,000 days, for the next 40 years of your life, spend yourself. That's what I see the scriptures say. Is the ultimate danger that you would miss your destiny, that you would not accomplish what you were born to do, that you wouldn't look out for yourself? Because the American mantra is, you do you, you take care of yourself. But what part of looking at Jesus, who's God, hanging on a cross, giving his life for you, would say, live every day for yourself? It doesn't seem like loneliness is the ultimate danger, because it says that you can be entirely loved. Sin's not the ultimate danger, because you can be entirely forgiven. Suffering and pain and evil aren't the ultimate danger, because Jesus will end those soon. The ultimate danger, according to the scriptures, is that you would miss Jesus. That's the ultimate danger. Jesus is the prodigal God from Luke chapter 15. And when you hated him and wanted Jesus dead, he wasn't offended by that. He didn't walk away sobbing with his feelings hurt. When you went to the far distant land and you squandered everything good, that whole time, God was actively pursuing you. He was right there with you. When you finally decided to return, to your shock, he was already there looking for you while you were still a long way off. It was he who came and found you and restored you as sons and daughters. This is Jesus. Jesus is the author of life. You have breath because he created you. He holds you together, the scriptures say. And if you forgot to think about you even for a nanosecond, you would cease to exist. And for the rest of eternity, he will hold every atom of your soul together, and you will live forever because of who God is. He is the judge judged. It's the only place in any religion for all of time where the God who is rightly on his lofty and high throne would come down and look at you and say, my sweet daughter, my great son, you couldn't possibly bear the wrath that's been built up against you that you rightly deserve. And so I'll take it for you, me the judge, judged by your wickedness, because I love you and I adore you. This is Jesus. And if you have Jesus, then you have everything. And if you miss Jesus, then you've succumbed to the ultimate danger. You have lost mercy, you have lost grace, and you have forfeited eternity. This is why Jesus has no interest in you being a good moral person. Instead, he wants you to fall down before his son and be changed by him. And so when we talk renovation and when we talk change, we're not saying adhere to dogma. What we're saying is find freedom in life in Jesus. That's the change that we're trying to push for, right? And now, in every part of the scripture, there's statements that seem like they're morally driven, but they're not about ethics. Instead, they're pointing to the greatness of your need for Jesus, right? In the Ten Commandments, where it says, hey, don't lie. Why does it say that? Does God need you not to lie? No, this is why. When you lie, you have to create a second set of lies to cover the first set of lies, and a third to cover the second. And so you begin to live in this place of captivity where you're never really sure if you're yourself or you're just living out different manifestations of lies. And you break relationship because they don't know if they can trust you and they don't have confidence in you anymore. And so Jesus is saying, don't lie, knowing that you can't not lie. And when you lie, it will either make you captive or awaken you to a need for something greater than yourself. Or in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus gives maybe the best statements of morality, which really aren't statements of morality, where he says, if you look at a woman lustfully, you've already committed adultery. That seems real frustrating, doesn't it? All of us are adulterers now. And the point's not, don't look lustfully. You don't have a chance for that. The reality is that you've broken it already and you need Jesus to come into your life. Or this, maybe the greatest morality statement ever. Don't put another God before me. There is no other God. And so whenever you try to put something in your heart to take my place, it's going to ruin you. If you make a woman God, she's a terrible goddess. If you make money God, it will ruin you. If you make prestige God, it will fall short. And he's put this desire in your heart, knowing that you'll try these things and using them to startle you, to wake you up so that you might see him. Everything is pointing to Jesus. And we saw that last week in Luke chapter 7. Where a woman who's a prostitute finally gives up on her life and she risks everything believing that Jesus is her only hope. So she runs to Jesus and falls down at the feet of Jesus and takes this vial of perfume that represents her hope and her purity and her pricelessness and pours it out at the feet of Jesus, and then she just waits. And what Jesus does next is the topic of conversation for today. If Jesus rejects her, he rejects us and we have nothing. But if Jesus receives her, then Jesus receives us and we have everything. So let's turn to John chapter 21. We're going to start with verses 1 through 3 for a little background information to set the scene for us. Here's what it says. After this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias. And he revealed himself in this way. Simon Peter, Thomas called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, I am going fishing, right? That's kind of the introduction of the resurrection. Hey, I'm out going fishing. Peter had this mountaintop experience. And maybe you've had a mountaintop experience where you saw God with clarity that you hadn't seen before. You sensed the presence of the Spirit in a tangible way. Mercy was just overwhelming. But nobody can live on the mountaintop. Sooner or later, you have to come back down. And when you come back down, the farther you are from that mountaintop experience, the more it begins to lessen and become foggy. The more likely you are to return to what you knew best. In this case, fishing. Consider Peter's life. He had had a 3-year-long mountaintop experience with Jesus. He had seen Jesus heal leprosy, which was impossible. He had seen Jesus speak words to a dead little child and the child walk again. He had seen Jesus walk on water, and then in bravery, he stepped out and took one step on the water. He himself, Peter, had been sent out, and he had healed the sick and set captives free, and even Satan fled his presence. But then all of a sudden, this mountaintop experience comes crashing down right before him. Jesus, who's God and his best friend, is kidnapped, tortured, crucified, and his body is stuffed into a tomb, and everything becomes foggy, and it fades down before him, and it goes back to what he's most accustomed to. If you're a follower of Jesus, this has probably happened to you in some manner or another. The work that Jesus has done in your life has started to fade some. Grace leaks. Forgiveness gets clogged up in our hearts. Our cynicism rides. Apathy sets in and faith wanes. You don't even remember what really happened. You never really thought you believed. You can't believe that you adhered to any part of Christianity at any time at all. And in that moment, when things start to become cloudy, what are you going to do? Are you just going to walk away? Like it was a figment of your imagination and not have any bravery to doubt your doubt? Or are you going to cling to a mountaintop experience that's becoming less and less in your life, but you're not courageous enough to walk away, nor are you courageous enough to dig deeper? And so you're going to be a lukewarm Christian all the rest of the days of your life. It's just going to be blah and mundane and boring, and you'll kind of come to church some, and you'll kind of claim to be a Christian, but nothing more is changing in your life. What are you going to do? Because that's what Peter's faced with. And as he returns to fishing, what do you think he's going through? Can you imagine what's in his heart? There's just one thing. And I'm going to tell you what that one thing is, and then I'm going to show you so you don't think I've developed this. Peter was struggling with entitlement. How could he not? Consider the life that he had lived. He left everything to follow Jesus. His family, his job, his favorite coffee shop. He loved the sea, the ocean. He wanted to be on it every day. He left that. He took great risks. He was ridiculed by his family. He was kicked out of synagogues. He couldn't follow his old religion because he was following Jesus. He even attacked a Roman soldier one time. That's like punching John Jones, the MMA champion, in the face because he doesn't like the Wolfpack. It seems reasonable at first, but it's a horrible idea. That's what he's done. And so when Jesus dies on a cross, he's thinking, I shouldn't have given this much. You owe me, Jesus. You owe me honor. You owe me some manner of payback, because look what I sacrificed for you. I can't believe you took me through this scenario. He's absolutely entitled. Entitlement says, I'm owed. You owe me. Now, every human being struggles with entitlement. One thing that we hope to do at Vintage in community groups and up front on Sundays and in any gathering and at coffee shops over a meal, we want to point to Jesus and confess our need for him so that you might see that we need him and realize that you need him as well. And on an honest level, I'm just eaten up with entitlement. I'm entitled to time off because I work hard. I'm entitled to money because I've earned it. I'm entitled to sexuality because that's the way I'm wired. God did that, not me. I'm entitled to things. You have things. I should have things too. I'm entitled to grace. I've given you a lot of grace. You better give me grace back. I'm entitled to acknowledgement. I've seen you. I hear you. I acknowledge you. I meet with you. You better acknowledge me back. Just eaten with this. I feel like I'm owed by people. And you struggle with it too. If you live with anybody, you feel like they owe you. That's just human nature. Whether it's a roommate or a spouse or a parent or a kid, they owe you. Come on. My wife owes me. I can clean faster than any human alive. I worked at a restaurant bussing tables for 8 years. I can do all the dishes, vacuum the house, dust the house, do all the yard work, clean the bathrooms in 8 minutes. And it's done really well. And so then I sit back and I look at my wife and I think, she owes me. She certainly owes me. And do you know why I think that? Because my eyes are on myself. I didn't see her do all the laundry, raise 3 kids, save a puppy, rescue an elderly man, tackle a robber, solve global warming, and love me all at the same time. But those things don't matter because I only see myself. That's entitlement. I'm owed. Your company owes you. You're really gifted. You don't even have to work that hard. And you don't have to put the hours in that you're supposed to because you're so gifted. You take more time at lunch. You take more time off than you're given. Your church owes you. If the church had any idea what you've done for it, how you've bled for it, how you've sacrificed for it, they definitely owe you. Your kids owe you. Your parents owe you. Everybody owes you. Do you know why that's the case? Here's why. And it's perfectly normal. Every human being has needs, and those needs have to be met. It's inescapable. And you go through life and these essential needs aren't met. And when these needs aren't met, you start to fend for yourself. Your eyes go to yourself. So one of the needs that we all have is just basic physiological needs. You need water and food, and you need air and shelter. Did you know this, though? Almost 150,000 children in North Carolina don't have enough food to eat. So do you know what happens to them not having that basic need? They start to fend for themselves. Entitlement sets in. And who could blame them? They have to have food. They have to have that need. And so they start to fend for themselves, protect themselves, accomplish for themselves. Their eyes are on them. There's the need of safety and security. Every human being needs to be safe. But trauma happened when you were young. Assault happened when you were older. You were bullied in high school. You were bullied as an adult. And so you don't feel safe. And you have promised that's never going to happen again. And so your eyes turn in on yourself. You have the need for emotional fulfillment. Nobody escapes it. It's not because you're weak and have emotional needs. No, every human being needs to be unconditionally loved. You need to be praised and applauded and celebrated. You need to belong. And even if you had great parents, your parents can't love you unconditionally. So you start to fend for yourself and look out for yourself. And when your eyes go to yourself, do you know what's going on? The ultimate danger. The ultimate danger. You're looking at yourself and you're saying, I've accomplished this. I can do this because God couldn't. And that, my friends, is religion. Even if you're an atheist, you're living out religion. You're setting up a system where you've fended for yourself and taken care of yourself. Entitlement set in and change won't happen because the only thing that's really processed through your mind is me and I'll take care of it. Right? So when you're looking at yourself and when entitlement is set in, you'll never have life. And do you know why that is? You're the victim. Everybody owes you. And when everybody owes you, all you can set your mind to is them paying you back in the proper way. And so you set out to do that. And very counterintuitively, what you do is you think you're in control. You owe me. I'm going to fix this for myself. But you take power and you give it to somebody else because they owe you. They're in control. And so this whole time you think you're fixing things while they have the power and you're victimized and you just are stuck in this place. That's what entitlement does to us. Now, Peter struggled with entitlement. And so you don't think that I've just contrived this to make it fit in the sermon. Matthew chapter 16 says this. There was rumor that Jesus was going to go back to Jerusalem. And everybody knew if Jesus went to Jerusalem this time, he would be kidnapped and tortured and killed. And Peter thought to himself, if he's tortured and killed, they're going to catch us and kill us too. This isn't very good for me. And so he goes to Jesus and he says, Jesus, you kind of have this God thing going on. It works for you. You can walk on water and heal people. But listen, you're not going back to Jerusalem because you going back to Jerusalem's not good for me. What allowed Peter to rebuke Jesus? Entitlement. His eyes were on himself. My plan's better than your plan, God. My thoughts are better than your thoughts. My ideas are better than your ideas. And so we're going to do it my way because you, God, owe me. You're not going to die yet. There's still stuff that you're supposed to do for me. And then in Matthew chapter 17, Jesus takes Peter up for a mountaintop experience. They were on top of a mountain. And on top of the mountain, Jesus shows him his loveliness and his grandeur and his light and his mercy and his glory. And Peter had never seen or even imagined something as great as the glory of God. And he looks at Jesus and he says, this is really good for me. So I'm going to build some tents and we're going to stay here because this is so good. I mean, forget all the people that need to be rescued. Forget all the people that need to be healed. Forget that you are the one who is going to change the world and bring redemption into it. Who cares about those things? This is really good for me, Jesus. We're staying here. This is decent payback for what you owe me, Jesus. So when entitlement is in your heart and when you think people owe you, what happens in that moment to your heart? More simply put, when you're owed and people don't pay you back, how does that affect you? Not too long ago, I had some grading work done to our yard. We had flooding underneath our house a couple of times, and I had spent midnight hours digging trenches and rainstorms and trying to build retention walls, and we paid professionals to come and help. And the very last part of the job, I was just worn out, didn't have any more energy. So around the edge of our house, we're going to have somebody lay rocks, and I paid a landscaper. And I talked to the rock quarry, and I knew how much rock that we needed. It was one truckload, and we had everything situated. The guy brings the truck over, dumps the rock out, and it only took care of like a third of the job. And so he goes to get a second load, comes back, and it only does like 3/4 of the job. And I just didn't understand what was happening. So I called the rock quarry again, and they told me how much rock he had gotten. And the only plausible explanation was this guy was taking the rock, dropping some off at his shop, and bringing the remainder to my house. So I'm furious, and I'm on the phone with the rock quarry. And then I think, the landscaper has left my backyard, and my lunatic dog is in the backyard. I better make sure the gate's closed. I look out the window, and the dog's running towards the street. Now, the lunatic dog is hard-headed. I'm not really worried about him getting hit by a car. I'm worried about him attacking other dogs. So I drop the phone, run outside, and sure enough, he's attacking another dog. And this man is squealing and yelling, trying to get his dog off, and I'm trying to pull my dog by his back legs, and it's just this mess. And the guy starts threatening me, which is understandable. My dog was attacking his dog. And so finally, I get inside, and I put the dog down, close the door, walk to the back, and then somebody starts kicking on my door as hard as they possibly can. I'm like, the guy's come back to beat me up. Like, what am I supposed to do? Do I call the police? Do I go out there? Do I get my dog and stick him on his? What do I do? And so I open the door, and it's the landscaper. And I look at the landscaper in the eyes, and I say, you owe me rock. Now, if that statement ever comes out of your mouth, you're insane. There is no other way to typify it. You have lost your sanity. You owe me rock. Like, how does that come out of your mouth? That's what entitlement does to you. When you're entitled, your mind fixates on something, and you can't think about anything else. Your heart is amped up, and you have emotions stirring in you. You're going over the speech of what you're going to say to that person. Now, never in that speech was, you owe me rock. It was more eloquent than that, but still you have this speech going on, and you're just tied up. You're totally tied up. You salvage what people owe you. Do you know why you think your spouse or your friend or Jesus owes you? Because your heart can't multitask. Your heart is the control center of your life. It guides everything. And it only has one focus. And when you're entitled, your single focus is yourself. And when you're focused on yourself, you're blind to everything else. And when you're blind to everything else, there's no way that you can change. There's no way that redemption is going to come. There's no way that you're going to be freed from the broken things that are holding you because you're only focused on yourself. That's the power of somebody else owing you, being entitled. Now listen, this is really important. Do you know what the opposite of entitlement is? Think about it. Forgiveness. Forgiveness is the opposite of entitlement. The word forgiven does not mean a clean slate. Theologically, on a Christian level, it's not just that everything is back to the beginning and you can write new stuff on the chalkboard. That's not it at all. The epistemology of the word, the history of the word forgiven, goes back to the original meaning to untie. Jesus is untying the captivity of your heart. He's undoing all those things that you think people owe you for, and he's letting you see yourself plainly. Just the word itself, forgiven. It's given. It's the opposite of you're owed. Somebody owes you. No. It's everything's been given to you. And what's been given to you? Jesus himself. So every word that Jesus ever spoke are now the words that you've spoken according to the Father in heaven. All of the loveliness of Jesus has been given to you. That's forgiveness. All of the power of Jesus has been given to you. That's the promise of the Holy Spirit, right? Jesus says in John chapter 17, now the Father looks at me and says he adores me. And because you believe in me, the Father adores you just like the Father adores me. That's what you've been given. And when forgiveness sets in your heart, people don't owe you anymore. Your spouse doesn't owe you. No. Your spouse has been given to you by God. And all of a sudden, your spouse is a cherished gift instead of somebody who lives in your house who owes you constantly. Your church doesn't owe you. This church doesn't owe me anything. No, this church has given me a picture of Jesus and community and forgiveness and grace. God gave this to me. God gave you to me. God doesn't owe me anything. How can he owe me anything when he's already given me everything? He gave me his son, everything. So the moment that you stand in the presence of the all-powerful God and you hear, it's not that the slate's been wiped clean. That's way too small of a thing to be. I have made you just like me, and I've given you all of myself. Then, in that moment, entitlement is liquefied, and Jesus changes your heart. So, what I want to do with the last 7 minutes or so is show you how forgiveness changes Peter in hopes that we would allow that same forgiveness to change us. Now, the problem that Peter had is he didn't really understand how messed up he was. And I have that same problem, and I'd like to humbly suggest you have that problem. You don't really understand how great your sin is. Last week in Luke chapter 7, Jesus told the parable of two debtors. One debtor owed $5, and he couldn't pay. And another debtor owed $50 trillion, and he couldn't pay. So the person that had both debts comes to them and forgives the $5 and the $50 trillion. And Jesus asked a self-righteous guy, a Pharisee, who do you think loved more in return? And the Pharisee kind of grumpily said, well, I guess the $50 trillion person did. And Jesus said, you're exactly right. Now, Peter hears the story, and do you know what Peter's response is? That's a good story. Maybe I'm the $5 debtor. That's what I do. And that's what you do. Oh, yeah, there's some $50 trillion debtors in the world, but not me. I'm a pretty good person. I'm a $5. I can earn my way out of that way. I can repay that. I got this. I go back to religion in that moment. And so if you look at how Jesus dealt with Peter, he's constantly trying to show Peter how he's a $50 trillion debtor, right? When Peter in Matthew chapter 16 says, you're not going to Jerusalem, he's just looking out for himself. It's not that big of a deal until Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. That seems a little bit large of a response, doesn't it? But he responds this way because Peter has just fallen for the ultimate danger. He has just missed Jesus. And when you miss Jesus, you've missed everything. And so he's trying to say, Peter, no, you're far more broken than you ever really imagined that you were. We're near Jesus' crucifixion. Jesus says, everybody in this room is going to betray me. You will walk out on me. And Peter stands up and he goes, I won't. All these other people are sinners and they're cowards, but I'm telling you right now, I will not. And then it says, in just a little while, Jesus had been taken and he's being led away to a false puppet court. And Peter's following in the shadows and a little girl comes up to Peter. No authority, can't kill him, can't arrest him. And says to Peter, aren't you one of Jesus' followers? And Peter says, I don't even know him. I don't even know him. That's the ultimate danger. He just fell for it again. And Jesus knows this. And so after the resurrection and all of his glorious power, Jesus stands before Peter and says, Peter, do you love me? Do you know what he's doing? He's trying to show Peter just how deep his sin is. And Peter's eyes are starting to lift, and his heart is starting to rise, but he doesn't get it yet. He's starting to, and that's your story, and that's definitely my story. He's gone from a $5 debtor to maybe a $1 million debtor, but it's still not that outrageous. And so Jesus looks at Peter and says, Peter, I know how great your sin is. Do you love me? Right? The message is clear. Your sin is far greater, but grace is greater than even your sin. I'm not leaving you, Peter, until you understand how much of a sinner you are, but how much greater my forgiveness is than you could ever even imagine. So for a third time, Peter, do you love me? Do you know what it says after that? Peter was grieved. Maybe the sweetest sentence in all the scriptures, because he finally sees. He finally understands. He finally gets his mind wrapped around. I'm the $50 trillion debtor. And Jesus didn't leave me alone until I realized I can't handle this, but he already has. And in that moment, his life is radically turned upside down from seeing Jesus owes him to realizing that he's been given everything already. You're the $50 trillion debtor. There's no chance that you have to undo that. You can't fix yourself. And so Jesus will stand before you and ask you as many times as it takes, do you love me? And every time that you don't yet understand the depth of your sin so you can see the height of his grace, he'll just ask you again and again, and sooner or later, you'll be grieved. And then forgiveness will be yours, and you'll be overwhelmed by his mercy and his grace. All right, so in conclusion, every week in this series, I've asked you to do just one thing. Just own one thing. Take one step. The first week, I try to challenge you. Would you see that you're broken like me? And it's not little brokenness. It's outrageous brokenness. Would you own that? That that you've had a porn problem for so long that your brain has been rewired, and now because of shame, you can't stand the idea of going back to Jesus. That you were assaulted, and you feel dirty, and that you can never be clean or right again. And that brokenness wasn't yours, but it was done to you, but still the effect is the same. That you have deep self-hatred. You cut yourself and you starve yourself, or you just always are in a place where you belittle yourself. It's okay to be broken. All of us are. And do you see how that brokenness, week two, is causing you to run away from God, flee from God, right? Your shame and porn is making you never go back to God. That's your biggest problem. Your self-hatred is causing you to run away from God. That's your biggest issue in all of life, that you're running away from God. And so week three was this woman had no other hope, no other place. So she just fell at the feet of Jesus. And she took that priceless thing of purity, her hope, and she poured it out. And she said, Jesus, it's yours because I can't do anything at all. And she's in that risky, horrible place. If he rejects me, I have nothing. And Jesus forgave her and accepted her. Jesus forgives you. And that's the only way that change happens in your life. You've been given. You've been given the Son of Jesus, the Son of God, Jesus. And everything Jesus is, you now are. That is renovation. And that's what we're asking for. Would you pray with me? God, we ask that in this moment, Jesus would be so tangible in this room. We would feel his presence like that prostitute in Luke chapter 7 knew that you were right there, that God himself was there in flesh and blood, and that we would have the courage to pour ourselves out before you. Whatever we hold on to, whatever shames us, whatever makes us flee you, whatever we put our hope in that's not you, and that in that moment we would look into the very eyes of Jesus and we would hear a sweet voice say, my sweet daughter, I forgave you 2,000 years ago. It's time to come home and be changed. My son who I love so much, I'm proud of you. And the Father sees you just like he sees me. Be changed. Lord, do that here for our friends that are doubters and seekers, and for us as followers of Christ, move in the same potent way. We love you, Jesus, and we ask these things in your name. Amen.